a few moments ago, the secretary to Sir John Kerr came and actually read the announcement that the double dissolution bills were to go ahead. The Governor General of Australia, do by this my proclamation dissolve the Senate and the House of Representatives, given under my hand on the Great Seal of Australia on the 11th of November 1975, by His Excellency's command, Malcolm Fraser, Prime Minister, John R. Kerr, Governor General. God save the Queen.
Well may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor General.
1975, 44 years ago, on the steps of Parliament House in Canberra, Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, well, ex-Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, was being slightly annoyed about recent political developments. Malcolm Fraser forms government and then goes on to win the election. And the rest, they say, is history, but is it? For many, that chapter in Australian political life is an itch that needs scratching. On LNL, my next guest, Jenny Hocking, has doggedly campaigned to uncover the full story behind the dismissal. Professor Hocking is Emeritus Professor at Monash and Distinguished Whitlam Fellow at the University of Western Sydney, and of course is the author of a two-volume bio of EGW. June, welcome back.
Good evening, Philip. Thanks for having me.
You were in court on Friday seeking the release of the palace letters. You've had the weekend to get over your disappointment. How are you feeling?
Oh, look, it is a great disappointment, of course, that we were not successful. We challenged the description of the letters between the Governor-General, Sir John Kerr, and the palace, but that is largely the Queen and her private secretary, at the time of the dismissal. And we were unsuccessful. We did have a 2-1 decision, so we had one of the three judges in the appeal in our favour, and that's a very interesting judgment. I mean, they're all very interesting, of course, very considered and very detailed judgments, but there is a difference, obviously, between the majority decision and the decision of Justice Flick, which was the decision we'd hoped to get from two.
Can this go to the Supremes? Can we go to the High Court?
Look, it could go to the High Court. I mean, we've already been to trial to a single judge of the Federal Court. We did not succeed there. We've now gone on appeal to the full bench, which are three sitting justices of the Federal Court. And as I said, it was a 2-1 decision. So, look, I'll wait and take advice on where we go from here. And obviously, you know, I'll need to discuss that with our wonderful, extraordinary legal team, and see whether we think that there are points on which we can go further to the High Court. But it is a possibility. Yes, it's something we're considering.
I'm making the point that I think they're love letters between John and the palace. But you'd probably dispute that. And
well, I would, largely because. I've seen extracts from some of the letters. I mean, there's a great deal of material that's come out in recent years, largely through, you know, my quite unhealthy obsession with Sir John Kerr's archives, most of which are, of course, open in the archives. These letters are not, but also through other archives, Malcolm Fraser's and Reg Withers having been particularly important in unravelling the story of the dismissal. But there were among Kerr's papers extracts, only very short extracts from about 7 of these palace letters, and in the course of this court case, that's been acknowledged that they are extracts from palace letters, and they're very bland, pedestrian descriptions of events, of political happenings, of discussions, in particular with Gough Whitlam. What is interesting is that, and this is only 7 of what we think to be in the order of 40 or 50 letters among this grouping called palace letters, but it's interesting that he mentions the word dismissal, and obviously the fear of either his dismissal or Whitlam's dismissal is uppermost in those letters that he's sending to the palace at the time. So there's a couple of things that we know and areas for concern in what we already know that Kerr was discussing with the palace.
The reason I suggested there's something else going on is because he wrote so frequently.
Oh, he did.
Sometimes 5 letters a day.
it is an extraordinary amount of material. And yes, others have commented also that, you know, this is quite a bizarre situation. But I think it does fit part of a pattern that we now know, we didn't, of course, know for many years, but we now see in Kerr's behaviour, which is that he cultivated almost, I think, the key individuals and the key institutions that he would need to have, if not behind him, at least aware of the direction he was going in. And I include in that what we now know was his prior contact with Malcolm Fraser. We know that, as I revealed in the dismissal dossier only a couple of years ago, from Reg Withers' papers, a posthumous interview which only became available a couple of years ago, in which he recounts being in Fraser's office when Kerr made a secret private telephone call prior to the dismissal. Now this had been denied for decades, but that, together with, of course, the revelations about Sir Anthony Mason's involvement, all of this had been kept from the Australian people for decades. But what Kerr is doing there is ensuring that key individuals from key institutions that might otherwise have not accepted the path he was taking were all at the very least aware of it and not going to speak out against it. And I think that makes sense when you think back to the unprecedented nature of what Kerr did. He could not have gone down that path and replaced an elected government that retained its majority in the House of Representatives at all times, that is the Whitlam government, with the leader of the opposition that not only did not have the confidence of the House, but which the House voted a motion of no confidence in that afternoon, if he did not know that Malcolm Fraser would accept that commission and be prepared to stay in office despite losing a motion of confidence.
You've mentioned that the word dismissal occurs, but it may be him, maybe Kerr, worrying about his own. This is outside the terms of reference of the letters, but why the hell didn't Gough move to dismiss Kerr?
Look, it's not something that Whitlam would have done, in the sense that he had an extraordinary, and still maintained even after the dismissal, an extremely strong commitment to the different roles and functions of the different arms of government.
In other words, he took them very, very seriously.
Oh, absolutely. And you can see that, I think, in his response to the dismissal, which was not, as his wife Margaret Whitlam advised him to immediately do, tear it up and tell Kerr to get over himself. It was to accept that letter and to go off and fight the election on that campaign, even though he thought it was grossly improper not to act on the advice of the Prime Minister, as Kerr had refused to. Well, you have to remember also that Whitlam had gone into Yarralumla that afternoon believing, and Kerr had led him to believe, that they were to call the half Senate election. I think this is often forgotten in the history. This is why Whitlam always called it an ambush. Now, Kerr refused to accept that advice when they had discussed the advice over the previous 4 days. They'd discussed the wording of the announcement just that morning. And instead, as Whitlam moved to hand Kerr the letter, the formal advice for the half Senate election, Kerr refused to take it and said, I have instead a letter of my own for you, which was, of course, the famous dismissal letter. So all of those things, Whitlam never had an opportunity to remove Kerr, and he was unaware that Kerr was actively deceiving him at that point.
Is it the case that all correspondence between Queen and GG are deemed personal?
Certainly in this case, yes. The letters that are in this bundle date the end point and the start point are over the entirety of Kerr's tenure as Governor General. So certainly the ones that we're seeking, that's the case, and that is the case in the archives for the Royal Correspondence, and has been for some time. But of course, In the intervening time, we've had the passage of our own legislation, that is the Archives Act, and one of our, of course, very strong views is that the Archives Act does not make this very clear distinction between the Governor-General's records. It was certainly something that was considered in the earlier drafts, but it's not explicit. It's more of a confused, if you like, partial distinction in the Act to remove the Governor-General's records, and that formed a very strong part of our case, that it's not clear that these records ought to be excluded, and unfortunately we were not successful in having that argument before
this,
the court.
This is Alan Allen. I'm talking to Professor, indeed Emeritus Professor, Jenny Hocking. Now, with this decision, the monarch's embargo over release will continue till at least 2027, potentially indefinitely.
Yeah, these terms were put... It's very interesting to look at the terms of default, actually, because personal records can contain their own terms of access, unlike Commonwealth records that go into the archives and then have to be released after the public access term, which has been 30 years, is now reducing to 20. But unlike that, these come with their own terms. The terms that were put on it, or as they currently stand, they were actually changed in the 1990s, which is interesting in itself. They were changed after Kerr's death. But as it stands, they're not for release until 2027. But even after that date, they require the approval of both our Governor-General's official secretary and the Queen's private secretary. So what remains is an effective final veto for the Queen's private secretary. If the Queen's private secretary, that is the Queen or the monarch, does not agree, those letters will not be released. It's as simple as that. So there is a potential indefinite embargo over them.
Jenny, any chance that other pieces of the puzzle will emerge? Might there be other documents waiting to be found?
Well, given what we've already found, which has been, you know, truly, truly startling, and I point particularly to the revelations of Sir Anthony Mason's long involvement with Kerr prior to the dismissal, which was hidden for 37 years, which Mason himself acknowledged once that came out in my biography. But other than that, I think it would have remained hidden. So having found, as we now know, such a vastly different history of the dismissal from the one we'd understood even 10 years ago, then yes, I would say nothing is impossible, because it's the story that keeps giving. And I think it does that. I think the history of the dismissal continues to unfold largely because of this extraordinary level of secrecy around what happened. And it's one of the really startling things as a historian to look at that material, to go back to first basics and find material in the archives, and to be truly shocked at the extent to which some of the key participants actively discussed hiding that material. And I'm speaking here of Sir Garfield Barwick and Sir John Kerr. There's a set of letters about 7 years after the dismissal, in fact it's on the anniversary of the dismissal, where they actually discuss at what point they should alert the Australian public to the role that they're aware of Sir Anthony Mason. And as if our history is their personal plaything, that they will determine at what point the Australian people can know that side of the story of the dismissal. Now, I found that extraordinary, that people at that level of public governance and public institutions could be discussing such a momentous event in our history, and when we might be able to know some of the key figures involved. Quite remarkable.
I can only agree wholeheartedly. Thank you, Jenny Hocking. The good professor is Emeritus Professor at Monash and, of course, Scough Whitlam's biographer.